We have talked about it endlessly over the last decade or so, and we've accomplished close to zip.
We know enough about our climate problem to know that it's serious and that we need to get started right away.
What we're seeing right now is a clear loading of the weather dice.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner. I like to say NPR's climate cast is really about three things, and that's what we're doing today. Climate news, climate science, and climate solutions. And that's kind of what I pitched to NPR when I proposed this a little over 3 years ago. And if you listen to us regularly, you know, of course, we cover climate change news as it evolves. We also kind of drill down into the science behind our changing climate, effects like sea level rise, extreme weather trends, even our economy. So today on ClimateCast, I'm happy to say we focus on solutions. What a concept, right? How do we change our carbon-based society to more climate-friendly energy sources and still grow economically? How do our cities, even our neighborhoods, embrace a modern energy future? That may be a good discussion on National Night Out tonight, right? And how do we all, what do we all do at home? What can we do today to mitigate our carbon footprints and adapt to changes in weather and climate? And, you know, I also want to hear from you today about what you're already doing at home or at work. What are you doing now to mitigate or adapt to climate change? And what questions do you have for our amazing guests today? Big scale stuff in the first half hour. We'll work our way down to the home scale after 10:30. I'm excited to say we've got an outstanding group this morning who can come at climate change solutions from very different perspectives. Dr. Richard Alley is a world-renowned climate expert. He's a professor at the Department of Geosciences and Earth Environmental Systems Institute at Penn State University. Hi, Richard.
Good morning, Paul. How you doing?
Hey, good to talk to you again. Dr. Elizabeth Wilson is a professor of energy, environmental policy, and law at the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. And she studies how energy systems are changing in the face of new technologies and new societal pressures. I'm thinking smart grid, right, Elizabeth? Is that one of your specialties?
One of the things I work on, yeah. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to see you. And Patrick Hamilton is the director of Global Change Initiatives at the Science Museum of Minnesota. He's recently guided an energy transformation project within the Science Museum. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning, Paul.
Good to talk to you all. I want to start a little bit big picture scale and work our way down to the level of homes. And Richard, I want to start with some science and news with you. We know the IPCC goal worldwide mitigation of carbon emissions is to limit the global temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius. We're already at 1 degree Celsius, even a degree and a half for the past several months. I know we don't focus on 1 year. We tend to think long term in these areas, Richard, but perhaps this is our third consecutive warmest year on record globally. Give us the big picture perspective on where we stand right now with global temperature trends and why this most recent warming spike is turning so many heads.
Yes, well, I have spent much of my professional career dealing with people who claimed that global warming stopped. You know, the climate, the temperature is an up and down when the sun gets brighter or dimmer, and an up and down when the Pacific sloshes, and an up and down when the volcanoes do or don't block the sun, and an up and up and up from CO2. And we get excited about the heat when we get the ups together, and then people who should know better keep saying, well, the year that you don't set a record, that must be the end of global warming. No, it is getting warmer. It is on track. We are really where we expected to be 20, 30 years ago. Climate science is proving to be accurately predictive as well as explanatory, and things that people said 30 years ago really are coming true. And we are on a track now that there isn't a lot of cushion for missing 2 degrees warming. We can still hold it to 2. We could probably hold it to 1.5, but there isn't a lot of slop anymore. We have spent 20 or 30 years not getting seriously started on that.
You know, let's talk a little about extreme weather, which is increasingly seems to be a part of this tapestry of a warmer, wetter climate. Ellicott City, Maryland, the latest extreme weather city to make news with that incredible flash flood last weekend. I saw the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. National Weather Service storm report showing 6 to 8 inch rainfall totals with an incredible rate of 4.5 inches coming in 1 hour. Richard, I'm sure attribution studies will be done here, but at first glance, do you see any potential climate change fingerprints here?
Very clearly. I mean, you know the story, Paul. You are a world-renowned meteorologist. It's always weather, and it always rides on the back of climate. And the amount of moisture in the air on average affects the strength of the worst storms on average. And so, yes, this was weather. This was your baby. But it happened on the back of loaded dice on a trend that is making the most extreme events more extreme. And so, yes, it is likely that we will ultimately see that things like this are happening more frequently and are more likely because we are warming the world.
Dr. Wilson, let's shift sort of from big picture extreme weather to the background hum of climate change and emissions. I saw a piece in The Guardian recently getting some attention. China appears to have reached peak coal in 2014, and now carbon emissions from coal appear to be falling in China. Why might that be an important trend?
When you're thinking about energy use globally, the big countries like China, the United States, Russia, Brazil, India, as well as all of the smaller countries, the EU, all of the countries that make up the EU as well, are really driving global emissions trends. And so when a country like China, which was projected to install another 1,000 gigawatts mm-hmm. of coal on their system, suddenly start to change their system or slowly start to change their system, it's something that people pay attention to. Whether or not and how coal operates in China, of course, depends not only on the technologies that they've installed and built, but also what's operated into the future, which is shaped by other market forces, other technologies, energy demand in China, global economic factors. And so whether this is a long-term trend or whether this is a short-term effect due to the economic situation in China, I think is a really interesting question. But the pressure there to deal not only with climate change, but more importantly, air quality,
yes,
is driving a very salient and strong political debate within the country. And I think one that's really interesting and important for us to watch and be aware of.
And that's been a huge component of this, hasn't it? I mean, we've all seen the pictures of hazy, smoky, polluted skies in Beijing and places like that. You think that's having a big impact in their energy policy in China?
Well, and I just want to reflect on us for a second. Mm-hmm. I did my PhD work at Carnegie Mellon, and at the turn of the century, you used to have to change your shirt twice in Pittsburgh during the day because the skies were black. You couldn't see the sky.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've cleaned up our air from coal-fired power plants through smoke control laws and then later through the Clean Air Act. But we've also transformed how coal works in our society and cleaned up air pollution. And right now in China, that air pollution driver is one that's very, very interesting and important for people who live in the city and politically as well. And so when we're thinking about climate solutions, I think it's also really effective to tie them into questions of livelihood and human health and well-being and the resilience that we talk about with needing societies that can adapt to more extreme weather events. So when I think about this technology and these solutions we're talking about, I'm thinking about a suite of technologies that are fulfilling multiple societal goals and purposes,
sure,
not just reducing CO2 emissions, but also making better air, ensuring that we have clean water, and ensuring that our cities and towns and communities are strong and resilient in the face of future changing climate.
I've heard it said, we didn't leave the Stone Age because we ran out of stones, right? There were better ways, better tools for doing things, and maybe that's kind of how we need to think about energy. Pat, what's your perspective on how we make this transition to more of a clean energy future going forward?
Well, my wife and I had the opportunity to be credentialed observers in Paris for the climate conference back in December, and I left that gathering with two salient messages. One was that never has it been more necessary to address climate change, and never has it been more possible. And what really drove home that message to me was that, of course, there was this enormous focus on the negotiations, but behind the scenes, there was an enormous foundation and corporate presence, a lot of interest on the part of corporations in the United States and around the world. General Mills, 3M were there, very interested in how climate solutions aid their businesses and also create the clean energy jobs of the future.
Let's talk about that a minute because, I saw a Thomson Reuters report this summer that lists the top 500 emitters globally, and some of those are now achieving economic growth while reducing emissions. So that's kind of that decoupling thing that we're talking about, right, where we grow our economy and at the same time we reduce emissions. What does the landscape look like for you as we start to see momentum in that area?
Well, I saw a remarkable statistic from Fortune magazine that there are now twice as many workers in solar industries in the United States than coal miners.
Wow.
And that growth in solar employment is double-digit growth annually. So we're seeing an explosive growth in wind and solar and energy efficiency industries in the United States. And those industries are now at scale. We've been looking for years about the idea that the renewable energy efficiency revolutions are somewhere in the future. We're living through that transition right now, and it's happening rapidly.
Yeah, we are here on ClimateCast this morning talking about climate solutions. Great guests today, Richard Alley from Penn State, Elizabeth Wilson from the University of Minnesota, and Patrick Hamilton from the Science Museum of Minnesota. Let's stick on this corporate thing for a minute. The White House EPA Clean Power Plan, we had a lot of companies sign on to that. Mm-hmm. Pat, as you pointed out, many of those are Fortune 500 Minnesota companies. Elizabeth, what's your perspective on how this evolves going forward on the corporate landscape?
Well, this is a really interesting question. One of my students did a really nice master's thesis looking at Cargill. Cargill spends $9 billion a year on energy.
Wow.
$9 billion.
Yeah.
And this is a global expense, and it's a company that is very vulnerable to changes in climate because they're producing agricultural goods across the world.
Well, I know they're aware, too, because we've had Greg Page on this program, the CEO, and I know they are very attuned to this.
Absolutely. And so you have companies like Cargill, like General Mills, and my student looked and compared to both of these companies during his master's project. And it was really informative for me for highlighting how companies are both conceptualizing this risk but also looking to manage it. One of the numbers I'm always a little bit skeptical about, though, is when companies focus on the carbon intensity and not the absolute emissions. And so a lot of times companies have intensity targets where they're producing less CO2 per dollar of revenue.
Okay.
But when you look at their actual emissions, because their revenue is growing, their emissions are actually going up as well.
The atmosphere doesn't care about intensity.
David
it cares
Keith
about
at Harvard would often say that, we're running out of atmosphere before we're running out of fossil fuels. And so when we're looking at these baselines and when we're engaging with our corporate leaders, I think it's really important to look at the total numbers as well as the intensity numbers, and we haven't always been good about that. I know as policy scholars, we've often given people a nice kind of smile and pass, in part because we don't have the policy tools to follow up.
All right, let's jump to the phones here, and I want to get some perspective from our listeners this morning. Chris in Bloomington, good morning. Do you have a question or comment for our guests?
Well, yes. I noticed that The IPCC has said that we need to reduce our emissions by 3% per year to stay within the 2% or 2 degrees above, pre-industrial levels. But my suggestion was a law, simple law, that said all new electric power generation shall be renewable. And that could begin the whole process, and we can add on to that as we go along. But that would deal with a lot of it right to begin with.
All right, Chris, good question. Thank you, Richard. Let's jump back to you. I know it's a little bit into the policy area, but your thoughts on the idea of, mandating more renewable energy.
Yeah, we're doing some mandating now on things like CAFE standards, trying to reduce gas mileage. When I've had the opportunity, and we'll turn it back to Elizabeth in a minute, but when I've had the opportunity to work with economists on this, they often say that regulation is a little bit like trying to squeeze a balloon in your hands, and it often squirts out between your fingers. And so you'll find a lot of them are really would like to see price signals, put a price on carbon, and then it can't squeeze out somewhere that you didn't see. And you're busily putting renewables into your car, but you're using fossil fuel to do something else. And so overall, the first time I ever testified to a subcommittee of the U.S. Senate, it was chaired by a Republican who seemed to want us to scare people a whole lot about how dangerous climate change was so that they could put a price on carbon so that the government wouldn't be regulating it, because the conservative approach was having price signals. And that was 13 years ago.
Elizabeth, it's interesting to me that, there are market forces at work here, it seems. And as we talk about transitioning into a more, clean energy future, what do you see happening?
So this is a really interesting question for me. I'm spending my sabbatical this year at the Danish Technical University in Copenhagen, or just a little bit north of Copenhagen.
Lucky you.
Everyone's welcome to come visit.
Yeah, right.
And one of the things I've really appreciated is the way that we think about climate and climate solutions in the U.S. really is framed as a market solution. But that's not true everywhere in the world. And so when we think about markets and prices, and actually, one of the things I was smiling about is, a carbon tax is also a policy tool. It's also, an instrument that we're using to steer the economy in different ways. Mm-hmm. And there's many different ways that we can steer the economy. A few years ago, I started focusing my research on policy implementation in practice, because how a policy plays out, whether it's a renewable portfolio standard or a carbon tax, is really going to depend on location, what the existing legacy infrastructure is, and in particular, how the policy itself is implemented. And those policy implementation is going to affect the planning, the operation, and the value of different assets on the electric grid, in people's homes, and how much people will pay and who will benefit from these types of changes. And so I think it's important to keep that implementation question in mind, with the recognition that West Virginia is going to have a very different response and cost of complying to a climate regulation than will a state like Hawaii mm-hmm. or California. And so this spatial differentiation, the different jurisdictions are really able and needing to find different solutions that fit for them. And we're seeing that already. I mean, there already are some jurisdictions like Hawaii that have decided they do want 100% renewables. And other places are focusing on more nuclear power, depending on what assets and resources they have. So I think it's important to realize that these solutions will be tailored for where they are implemented.
Implementation, Pat, yeah. That brings you to mind. I know that you've been working on reworking the way you use energy at the Science Museum. Give us an update on what you're doing to recapture what used to be waste energy there at the Science Museum of Minnesota.
Sure. So just a quick background. So Science Museum of Minnesota is a large building, and like most large buildings, we have simultaneous heating and cooling needs all year round. And we use a large amount of electricity, and electricity inevitably degrades into heat. And so large buildings have to manage that heat that's generated internally. And so the standard industry procedure for years, decades, has been to treat that heat energy as waste and to expel it from the building, and then use other forms of energy to do work that could have been done with the heat energy that's thrown away.
Mm-hmm.
So working with a consulting mechanical engineer here locally, we actually installed machines called heat recovery chillers.
And I've seen them. I've been fortunate enough to do a tour. They're pretty impressive. They're
absolutely
maybe the size of a Volkswagen bus or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they and it is fun now that we have both the exhibits in front of house and back of house. And we've started to do tours of the museum's advanced heat recovery project, because the machines are impressive and what they do, which is to capture the heat energy that formerly that we were expelling from the museum, and then reusing that heat energy. So we've actually cut the heating load at the Science Museum by 75%. So on a winter day, we are almost entirely heating the building from heat energy that formerly we were throwing away.
Let's stop there a minute. 75% you're cutting your heating costs in winter. That's pretty remarkable.
Yes, that is a dominant load. Heating load is, in the wintertime for heating, and yes, we've cut our heating load by 75%, our cooling by 33%, and overall, the Science Museum has cut its energy consumption by 40%.
Now, that's impressive. Now, that's one big building. How much are big buildings, that slice, that component of greenhouse emissions in the United States, what is that?
Well, it's a really important component because, for example, I did some back-of-the-envelope calculations that back in 2010, before the Science Museum embarked on this project, Science Museum alone used as much electricity as 300 households. So I was mm-hmm. figuring that's every household in an 18-block area of my neighborhood in St. Paul. So one building using as much electricity as 300 households. And when you multiply that by the number of large buildings in the Twin Cities in Minnesota across the country, it's a huge portion of the electricity that's generated in the United States.
And Elizabeth, I would think, and maybe Pat knows, you probably generated some jobs doing this.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, I think that's what is a really fun story about this, because we embarked on this project to save energy and therefore save money. And we're estimating that we're saving $200,000 a year with a payback of 4.5 years. But we also, looking at it at a larger scale, we helped employ the factory workers down in La Crosse, Wisconsin, that at the train factory that built the heat recovery chillers. We helped employ the truckers that delivered the equipment to the Twin Cities, and then the riggers that carefully lifted them off the truck and maneuvered them into position, and the concrete workers that poured the pads, and the pipe fitters, and the electricians, and the sheet metal workers, and the software engineers. All those folks moving in and out of the Science Museum over 18 months to do one building retrofit.
Elizabeth, let's multiply that out a little bit, right? If we start doing these kind of retrofits, it's got to create jobs, and I know we're already seeing boom in solar jobs and wind jobs. What does that look like going forward as an economic opportunity?
Well, and I think the important thing to remember, I know we're going to talk about the household very, very soon.
Yes.
But if you're thinking about building energy use, it's about 40% of U.S. energy.
40%. Mm-hmm. Just big buildings in the U.S.
All buildings.
All buildings.
And
okay.
So when we're thinking about this idea of retrofitting buildings, buildings live a long time. Mm-hmm. And so it's not only the new buildings we're building, but also, as you said before, the retrofitting of existing building stock. Richard Graves at the University of Minnesota Center for Sustainable Building Design talks about how every building needs to do as much as it possibly can. And I think the Science Museum is a perfect example of a building that's both dramatically cut its energy use. But when we're thinking about long-term system decarbonization, really decarbonizing not just 3% a year, but kind of 80% of how we 80% of reduction in how of greenhouse gases, mm-hmm. we're really looking at a fundamental transformation of how we use and generate energy. And so the longer-term trends are both retrofitting the existing building stock, but also making sure that the new buildings we're building are both as efficient as possible and doing as much as they can. And when I think about this, I think not only of just saving energy, but also I work on the grid. And mm-hmm. what types of services can these new buildings provide to also allow more variable resources like solar and wind to mm-hmm. better integrate into our electricity system? And there's a whole suite of electrical engineers now who are looking at even changing the fan speed and making it a variable fan speed, or shifting the temperature ever so slightly so it's imperceptible to us, to allow buildings to also provide grid services that will allow us to integrate more renewables on our system in very different types of ways. We often talk about storage, but also demand management and being able to fluctuate our demand and integrate it better with a variable electricity supply, I think is an exciting place for the future of these systems as well.
Richard, as a climate scientist, this must be music to your ears, I'm guessing, to hear that these things are moving forward.
Oh, it's just fantastic. You sort of think of an analogy that when we were kids, well, maybe not when you were a kid, when I was a kid.
Well, I'm not that far behind you, I think.
News either arrived at 5 p.m. or 6 p.m. on the evening news, or it arrived at your doorstep in a newspaper, and that was all you got. And all they could do was push out news. And power plants push out power that way. They just push it out. And now we get our news from everywhere all the time, from this wonderful selection of places, and we can generate news, and we can consume news, and we get it in all these different ways. And that's where the electric grid is heading. You can be a consumer, you can be a producer, you can be a storer, you can be a sharer, and it's going to be very complicated, and it's not going to be easy to get there. But you can see the old model of do it on their schedule starting to break down around the edges.
You know, Elizabeth, I want you to touch on this real quickly. If we talk about utility scale, power companies, things like that, what's the ground truth about power companies like Xcel shifting sort of that big scale energy sources from coal to more climate-friendly fuels? We know it's happening. What's the curve there?
And so we have Xcel in Minnesota, we have Great River Energy, we have Minnesota Power. One of the things I've really appreciated in this state is how different each of these utilities is, both mm-hmm. in terms of their legacy energy system and also what they've done in terms of reducing their greenhouse gas emissions. Xcel right now has the most wind of any utility in the country that they're operating on their system, and they've been very interested in that aspect of it. I think one of the things that Richard brought up that I think is very interesting, we're calling it the prosumer. the consumer that also produces energy. And this is part of a larger movement that's happening not only here but globally. This idea that people can, and communities and buildings and businesses can produce their own energy and manage their own energy in different ways. And as Richard said, it's creating this movement that, as researchers were calling, energy democracy. This idea that, that producing energy and managing the system is really changing how the game will be played and works. And this, for me, is why this question of implementation and practice is so critical, because utilities like Great River Energy, like Minnesota Power, like Xcel, like our municipal utilities, are really critical actors in making this transition happen and allowing or not different technologies like solar or small-scale solar, wind, or some of these demand-side management technologies to actually be implemented in practice.
Pat, I know you've worked a bit with Great River Energy for your project, I believe, at the Science Museum. What do you see the landscape here of solar and wind in Minnesota, for example? What's the total energy percentage production now from renewables, if you know, and where you think that's headed in 10 or 20 years?
Well, what's remarkable is if we look back at 2004, renewable energy, which then was primarily wind, was 2%.
2%.
It's jumped to 18% in just 10 years.
Wow.
And Xcel Energy is planning to cut its coal use, which was currently 37% of its fuel load, to 15% by 2030. So they're going to cut their carbon emissions by 60% in just a few years. So we're seeing a very rapid transition to wind and solar here in the United States, and in particularly in Minnesota. And actually, I think we are the beneficiaries of policy decisions that were made in China and Japan and Germany in recent years to really invest heavily in renewable energy. And that has just dramatically reduced the wind of solar.
Fascinating stuff to see how quickly that's happening. You're listening to ClimateCast. It's the Climate Change Solutions Roundtable here on NPR News Today. We've got some great guests in the next half hour. We'll focus a little more down to the home scale and what you can do at home today if acting on climate change is something that you're interested in. Or maybe it's something you're already doing. So now's a good time. Call us and tell us. If you're doing that, if you have questions for our guests, the number to call, 651-227-6000. Or you can reach us toll-free at 800-242-2828. We'll also bring in an expert on the booming solar and wind energy options in Minnesota and the Midwest who can tell us how we can opt in for solar and wind power from our homes or for our homes. But first, let's get some news. Here's Phil Picardi with a news update. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Paul. A bus crash on a central California freeway has killed 5 people and sent at least 5 others to hospitals. The Highway Patrol says the 5 injured were airlifted to those hospitals. The crash occurred on a state highway between the cities of Atwater and Livingston. Photos and video show the unmarked white bus crashed into the pole of a highway exit sign that appears to have torn through the middle of the vehicle. The Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal is high on the agenda for the talks that are underway at the White House between President Obama and the Prime Minister of Singapore. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are opposed to the deal, which is a key part of Obama's efforts to boost U.S. exports and build strategic ties in Asia. Mosquitoes in Miami, believed to be spreading the Zika virus to humans, have prompted what officials say is the first domestic health travel warning they can remember from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The warning applies to pregnant women and advises them to avoid the trendy rising neighborhood called Wynwood near Miami. Automakers are reporting lower sales in July as analysts say hot weather kept buyers indoors. GM says its sales fell 2%, while Ford's U.S. sales fell 3%. Both automakers reported declines in pickup truck sales, but there was strong demand for SUVs. State regulators say most communities in drought-stricken California remained on target for saving water in June. It was the first month local leaders were back in charge of conservation. State water regulators today released figures as California endures its 5th year of drought. And a wildfire in central California has destroyed 3 homes and grown to more than 3 square miles. The blaze broke out Saturday in the Fresno County town of Prather. About 300 people are under evacuation orders there. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:36.
On the next Morning Edition, hear from an actor whose search to define success led him to make a new film about improv comedy called Don't Think Twice. I'm Kathy Werzer. That story tomorrow on Morning Edition, 4 to 9 a.m. here on NPR News.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, Congressman Rick Nolan joins me to discuss switching his support for president from Bernie Sanders to Hillary Clinton. I'll then interview the newest member of the Minnesota Supreme Court, Ann McKeag. And then we'll learn about the quirky syndromes that only appear in certain places, and really only if you believe in them. We'll explain at 11.
Programming supported by Mayo Clinic's Transform Symposium. You can join Freakonomics co-author Stephen Dubner, rap artist Dessa, and explorer Will Steger to deliberate a sustainable future for health. September 14th to 16th in Rochester. Transformconference.mayo.edu.
Welcome back to ClimateCast, everybody, on Minnesota Public Radio News. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner, and today it's the Climate Change Solutions Roundtable. Your calls this half hour. What are you doing at home or thinking about doing at home to maybe change your energy usage or how you buy energy? Or what are you doing about climate change already? Call us with your questions or comments, 651-227-6000, toll-free 800-242-2828. We've got some great guests today. Elizabeth Wilson is back with us from the University of Minnesota, Patrick Hamilton from the Science Museum of Minnesota, and joining us now is Trevor Drake. He's co-director of the Clean Energy Resource Teams. That's a group that helps connect people and communities with clean energy options. Good morning, Trevor.
Morning, Paul.
Hey, let's talk about renewable energy options kind of at the home scale. We know solar and wind are booming in Minnesota and really nationwide. As home energy consumers, where do we stand today with options for buying our home electricity from wind or solar?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are four options that we generally talk about, and of course, there's a whole suite of technologies available. But the four main ones are individual solar. So folks could put a solar system on their rooftop or their land, and in some utilities in Minnesota, there are incentives to help with that. There's also a statewide incentive for panels made in Minnesota for four of the larger utilities. Folks can do a community solar garden subscription where instead of putting a solar system on their property, they are subscribing to a system that is on another property.
Let me just stop you there. Let's talk about solar gardens because we hear a lot about them. I don't think people know a lot about them. What is a solar garden?
Yeah, we get this question a lot. So this is a solar system that is put in a central location, and multiple individuals can subscribe to it. And it can be done a few ways. In Xcel Energy's territory, private companies are building these solar gardens and finding subscribers. In most other utility territories in Minnesota, the actual utility is building the garden, and their customers are subscribing.
Okay. And I have seen that there's a lot of these permits on the drawing board, right? Aren't there something like over 300 of these in line in Minnesota?
Yeah, for the Xcel Energy program, the developers need to apply to build the system and then interconnect it to Xcel's grid. And so that's the queue that we've heard about. Folks are waiting to get approved to do that.
All right. Let's grab a caller here. Paul in Edina has a question for us about community solar. Paul, what do you got this morning? Good morning.
Yeah, morning, Paul. Just wanted people to know that in Edina, we're the first city to have a community solar garden. It's going to be built on top of the Public Works building in Edina, and right now we're about 25% full of subscriptions. So what better night to talk about energy and solar than on National Night Out? So we're hoping that people will contact the city of Edina and find out more about how they can subscribe, because it's an immediate saver, and it gets people thinking about, you know, how do we make this transition that will get the country moving in a direction of renewable energy.
And Paul, I'm curious how it's being received in Edina.
You know, we're having everyone I talk to says, what's the downside? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And really, the only downside is filling out the paperwork, getting your data from Xcel Energy, and then figuring out, should we do 80% of our average bill or 100% or up to 120? Almost everyone I've talked to and gone through the process has signed up And they have lots of questions. What if I move? You know, what if I die? Can I give it away? And, you know, the program that we're working with Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light, is focusing on getting low-income people as well as big homeowners focusing. So we're trying to make it solar for everyone.
All right, Paul, great comment and question. Elizabeth, solar gardens, how do they fit into the smart grid?
I think this is a really interesting kind of configuration because you have private people who, I mean, we know that larger scale solar systems are cheaper than having it on your individual household. People can have better sites and lower costs. But this is, again, where for me, this question of implementation and practice is going to be fascinating to watch in Minnesota. Because as you mentioned, there, as Trevor talked about, there's a couple hundred projects queued up. But the Public Utility Commission and Xcel need to make some critical decisions as to how this will happen. And that's going to determine the value of these operations and how they operate in practice. And so I think as Minnesotans, we really need to be focused on our Public Utility Commission and how they're negotiating this, and also the utilities. These are tough things that are affecting what the future of these types of plants will look like and programs will look like. But they're pretty exciting options. And this whole idea of 120%, this is an arbitrary number that we chose. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, having public people invest in their energy system is a novel idea. And the 120% limit, this was a number that policymakers made up. Why not 500%? Why not 1,000%? I mean, so even how we think about this system and how we think about how we invest, there's a lot of kind of underlying policy decisions that have been made that are shaping how we are able to engage in this type of initiative like a solar garden.
Fascinating. Full disclosure, I am 100% Xcel Energy wind power customer. So I've chosen that option for myself. Trevor, this all sounds great, but I can hear people sitting at home going, all right, cool, but let's get real. How much does this cost me versus, you know, the power I'm paying for today if I haven't made a change?
Yeah, that's a great question. For the wind source program that you mentioned, a green pricing program, you and I have that program as well. You're paying just incrementally more. I pay maybe $3 more per month to be 100% wind powered. For rooftop solar, it really depends on a lot of factors. But the permitting for rooftop solar systems is done by local government, and so it varies from place to place. It also depends on the size of the system. For a community solar garden subscription, you can find a subscription where you are saving a little bit of money starting on day one, and that could carry on for the term of your subscription, which is about 25 years. And then it depends on what electricity prices do over that time.
Linda in St. Paul, good morning to you. What's your question or comment this morning? What are you doing at home?
Good morning. Our energy provider is Xcel Energy, and there are two major things that we're doing, or three. We've replaced all of our lights with LEDs and have done quite some years back. The other thing that we do, Xcel Energy has a program where in the summer, in the heat, in the prime heat drainage times, you can opt into their program where they lure the air conditioning automatically in your home, so that there's not quite such a drain in peak periods. The other thing that feels really important is that when the wind source program started, we signed up for that, and we purchased 400 kilowatts per month at $14.12 in May, and then we got a fuel cost charge credit, 400 kilowatts for $10.28. So that always feels very good to see that, and we feel we're part of the possible solution towards global warming.
Linda, thank you for your comment. Pat, your comments on that. And I also, if you get time, tell us about the parking ramp at the Science Museum, because you've done some big light bulb switches there, haven't you?
Sure. So let me just say a little bit more about WindSource. So Paul, like you, my wife and I also fully subscribe to WindSource. And the last time I did the calculations, we were paying a premium of 7 cents a day to get all of our electricity from wind. So it's such a cheap alternative way of getting your energy from a clean energy source. And you mentioned the parking ramp. So when the Science Museum first embarked on this effort to capture and reuse its waste heat, we estimated that our use of electricity would actually increase because the heat recovery chillers, of course, run on electricity. But we thought, well, the overwhelming reduction in our heating load would justify the slight increase in our electricity. Mm-hmm. But in fact, what we've seen is our electricity consumption plummet by 20%, in part because of the fact that we completely relamped our parking ramp with LEDs, which cut our electrical consumption by a third of a million kilowatt hours annually. And also refined the flow of air through the Science Museum. Elizabeth mentioned variable speed fans, and that is a dramatic reduction in the amount of electricity that the Science Museum is using.
Elizabeth?
I just wanted to add one thing on the program that Linda mentioned that Xcel has that cycles your air conditioning unit every 15 minutes during the peak heat times. It's called the Super Saver Switch Program,
yep,
and you can sign up for it, right?
Yeah.
I think I'm the only one here that doesn't have the Wind Source program then, and I didn't sign up for it for ethical reasons because I believe we should all have, at all costs, a green, clean, sustainable, resilient grid, and that the way electricity works, I mean, you don't actually have wind all the time because sometimes the wind isn't blowing.
Right.
You're paying premiums different times.
Sure.
But actually, the price and cost of wind on the system are less than any other asset. And so it's really fascinating for me to think about both the whole system and how it's evolving and changing over time. And it has changed dramatically, in part because of low natural gas prices, which we haven't talked about yet, but have 50% of the carbon of coal. And with natural gas boom with the shale gas and fracking have really changed how electricity is produced in states like Minnesota and all over the world. And so I think when we're thinking about these technologies, we need to think about them as systems and not only what we're using today, but also how we live as a system. If your house is, you know, forcing you to commute 45 miles each way to your workplace, you're using energy through your commute. Or like me, if you fly around the world too much, your carbon budget is really messed up. And so it's not only the electricity in my light bulbs, but how we use energy both in the embedded materials we have, like our cars and our other transport, but throughout our lives and throughout our industries and people who are in jobs and making purchasing decisions. Those decisions can have dramatic effects on long-term and short-term impacts for carbon and how the system works.
This sounds to me a little bit like the Wild Wild West, the future of energy and how it transitions here. We're young, I think, in this transition. What do you think, Pat? What's your perspective on how all this is coming together or not coming together?
Well, I think it's going to be it is a very entrepreneurial future when it comes to energy, but it's going to continue to be regulated. For example, the Public Utilities Commission, which has mandated very large increases in the renewable energy portfolio of Minnesota. And so we are greening the grid in Minnesota very rapidly, and Xcel Energy's Wind Source is an option for people to pay a very slight premium to put even more green electricity on the grid over and above what is already being mandated. So we are seeing, actually, I think we're seeing businesses moving ahead of policy because of the price signals that we're getting on the fact that wind and solar have dropped so dramatically in cost in recent years.
Well, this is a great discussion. We're getting perspectives from all levels here. Let's go to Doug in North Oaks. Doug, you want to talk about fireplaces? Good morning.
Hi. I love my wood-burning fireplace with bone-dry birch or oak. But my wife says the natural gas would pollute less and be better for the atmosphere. Who's right?
All right, great question, Doug. Who wants that one?
What kind of fireplace do you have, Doug? Is it just an open one, or is it one of the closed high efficiency burn ones?
No, this is an open fireplace.
Your wife wins.
Yeah, my wife and I have a house built in the 1920s, and it had a wood-fired fireplace, and we switched to gas several years ago. It is a much cleaner alternative.
You know, let's talk about the home level. We promised we would get down to this area. Pat, I know you've done some work here, but let's all jump in on this. What are the top two or three things we can do in our homes to kind of shrink our carbon footprint and adapt to the new climate?
So when my wife and I bought our house 25 years ago, we embarked on reducing the energy consumption of our home. And the nice thing about it is that the data comes every month in the form of a bill from Xcel Energy. And we've been able to reduce our electrical consumption to about a third of what a typical household is. And by two simple criteria, one is, which is when we are replacing an appliance, what are the most reliable manufacturers out there? Mm-hmm. And then choosing amongst those, which ones make the most energy efficient models? And refrigerators, freezers are huge consumers of electricity.
They're the biggies.
They're the biggies. And if you have a unit that is, I would say, 10 years old, chances are you can find a model that would serve you better and dramatically reduce the amount of electricity.
Okay. And Paul, I want to highlight, and I'm sure, and Trevor's group, CERTS, the CERTS program, has a lot of information on this, but there's a lot of programs to help people finance. Because a lot of times that upfront cost for energy efficiency improvements for new appliances, or if you're wanting to add more weatherization and use less energy for heating and cooling, can be really expensive. And so Trevor's organization, as well as Great Plains Institute, has a list of different types of programs that can help people financially and provide low interest loans or things like this to actually implement those if they're in a position where they don't have the cash to buy up.
All right, Trevor, that's a plug if I ever heard one. So why don't you give us quickly your website, and then also what are the big one or two things that folks can do at home if they're interested in doing that?
Yeah, so our website is cleanenergyresourceteams.org. Folks can go there and find all sorts of information on clean energy technologies and approaches and energy efficiency. And when we talk about the one or two things that folks should do, we actually recommend doing energy efficiency first.
Absolutely.
It's often the best bang for your buck. And you get these co-benefits from it. So you may be doing something that improves the value of your home or improves the comfort of your home, as well as reducing your energy use. So you get a benefit beyond just offsetting your usage. And then on top of that, I think it depends on what someone's goal is. And we often ask that up front, you know, what do you care about? What are your values? And then look at the options that can help you meet that.
When you say energy efficiency, you're talking about what? Insulation, windows, that kind of thing?
Yep, insulation, windows, the appliances in your home, and also just behavior that could help you use less energy, and lighting as well.
And Xcel or some of these utilities will send somebody out, won't they, to do an energy audit?
Absolutely. They have a lot of programs that will help provide that as well. I want to also call out an issue that we don't talk about often enough, which is renters.
Please.
25% of the people in this state rent, and so they're not going to be making investments in their apartments or others. And one of the real issues, I think, that we haven't really addressed is how we can help landlords bridge that gap and improve the buildings to actually save their tenants money. And right now, as a renter, it's hard to even get information on how much energy rental units use. And so I think, again, this is one of these policy issues and implementation and practice that affect some of the most vulnerable Minnesotans who spend the most amount of money on electricity and energy use. And so I just want to highlight, we always talk about solutions as if we could do it, but some people are renting and there might be other types of solutions that we need as well.
All right. I want to talk a minute about things like commuting, okay? One of the great things about my job here at NPR is I have the weather lab. It's at home. People know
awesome.
About it. It's a secret, very special sort of weather cave. But Minnesota Public Radio has allowed me to digitally commute, if you will. So I've reduced, say, a five-day-a-week commute to about one day. I'm usually down here one day, give or take, during a week. And I would hope that reduces my carbon footprint. If people are able to do that, how much of an impact does that actually have? Pat, do you have a sense for that?
Well, I think overall in the United States, transportation is at least a third of our energy consumption.
That's right.
So it's a huge portion of our carbon output.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so if folks can find a way to digitally commute,
it's
that,
true,
that
but
has
it also depends
impact.
On what you do. If you're actually just sitting home in the weather cave with your special bat cape.
Which I am, yes.
Absolutely. Then that's fabulous. But if you're taking your car and going on other trips and doing other trips and using energy in different ways, maybe it doesn't offset as much.
Of course.
So again, it's that whole system perspective.
Right.
And one of the things I've really been appreciating about living in Copenhagen is how easy it is to ride our bikes. We have great bicycle infrastructure in Minnesota, in the Twin Cities, where Minneapolis is one of the top 20 cities in the world. Copenhagen's number one. And it's amazing how you can go from bike to train to around the town and how there's special roads. And it makes it the default option for everybody. And so even having ability to kind of move around our cities in ways that allow us more flexibility, make those longer commutes possible as well. And I know we're having conversations here about rail and availability of transport in the future. And this is infrastructure that will last for decades.
We're getting a little tight on time, but there's a couple more things I want to cover here in the next 3 or 4 minutes. One is water. I want to talk about water. We know that climate change and water are very tied together. I have a little personal story with water management. Last summer, I volunteered for our neighborhood association board to be the guy responsible for turning our sprinkler, our irrigation system, on and off based on my rainfall forecast. Well, believe it or not, yeah, I'm the guy, right? Be that guy. Anyway, so here's what happened. We saved, we had used 889,000 gallons the year before. We dropped that to 129,000 gallons last summer. So we saved 760,000 gallons versus the previous summer. That's about 70%. So we saved that water. We saved the energy used to run the system, the wear on sump pumps, insurance claims from flooding because we had more room to absorb the heavy rains, all those kinds of things. That's one small neighborhood association. So I guess, you know, what kind of actions when we talk about water and climate change locally, what can people do, Pat, around their home?
Well, let me just give you an example of what we can do at a larger scale. So the advanced heat recovery that the Science Museum of Minnesota has employed, we saw an example of this at an industrial scale at Faribault Foods down in Faribault, Minnesota.
That's a great facility.
Where they implemented advanced heat recovery to substantially reduce their natural gas consumption, but it also saved them 54 million gallons of water annually.
That was 25% of their water usage, if I remember. 30% of natural gas and 25% of their water just through these retrofits.
One company.
Bean Cannery.
Yeah. Amazing.
It was fabulous.
How about our dollars, if people are so inclined? What are the best options for investing in climate friendly companies or retirement funds? I know this isn't your area of expertise, but does anybody have a thought on that?
Shoot, that's a hard one.
Well, actually, finally stumped him.
Yeah, not at all. I think one of the most exciting things for me was this Minnesota North Rhine-Westphalia tour that we did, because what we realized in Germany was that there's so many different finance options and so many different configurations. And when I get depressed, I just think about my 17-year-old daughter who says, "Mom, your generation's depressed. Mine doesn't have a choice. We need to make this work." And so given a changing climate, given all these technologies, she's incredibly optimistic and hopeful, and that's what keeps me going. And so investing in our youth as well and their training and their ability to solve these problems is probably a good bang for our buck.
You know, it's been a great discussion, you guys. Very appreciative. We covered a lot of ground today. We could have done another hour, I think, easily
on
this.
Two or three.
So let's do this again for sure. Dr. Elizabeth Wilson with the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota, thank you. Patrick Hamilton, Science Museum of Minnesota, and Trevor Drake with the Clean Energy Resource Teams. Thank you all. And, of course, Richard Alley from Penn State. Thank you for our first half hour. Excellent discussion today. That's it for Climate Cast this week. Thanks for listening, everybody. And remember, you can't see the whole world's weather and climate out your front window, but you can hear about it here. Tom Weber is up next after the news.